From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The new book, Because It Is Wrong, is a father and son collaboration. Charles Fried, the father, is a Harvard Law professor and former Solicitor General of the United States. Gregory Fried is chairman of the philosophy department at Suffolk University. And in addition to the generational divide, the Frieds are divided by political affiliation. Charles Fried served in the Reagan administration and has supported Republican candidates for president. Gregory Fried is a self-described independent. Together, they have attempted a rigorous analysis of, to quote the subtitle of Because It Is Wrong, Torture, Privacy, and Presidential Power in the Age of Terror. Charles and Gregory Fried, welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Robert.
Good to be here.
And I'd like you to elaborate first a distinction between wrongs that you make in the book. Torture is illegal because it is wrong. Government snooping on us without a warrant is wrong because it is illegal. Charles Fried, what's the difference?
The difference is that decent, civilized human beings will not, under any circumstances, torture or order torture. The Constitution itself says searches, which is what eavesdropping, snooping is, searches are only wrong if they're unreasonable or if they don't have a warrant. Well, that immediately shows there's a difference because you can have reasonable snooping, you can have snooping pursuant to a warrant. I don't care what kind of a warrant you have, you can't torture, and there is no such thing as reasonable torture.
And Gregory, you agree with that. The wrongness of torture is absolute, and there is no reasonable instance for it.
That's correct, and it is the burden of our argument to make that case, because I think it's essential to our identity as a nation that we hold to this absolute, among others, that torture is one of the things that a democratic republic must not do in order to retain its character.
Well, you address the cliched hypothetical that I'll repeat here and have you deal with. There's a devastating bomb about to go off. The clock is ticking. A detainee who is known to countenance and even plot mass murder is under interrogation. If holding his head underwater so that he feels the threat of imminent drowning, if that technique were proven efficacious and that it would break his will and avert the explosion, you, Charles Fried, would say, don't do it.
Don't do it, because it might break his will, but it dishonors you and the whole country. It is part of our history. Washington said, treat those captured in the battle with humanity, and let them have no reason to complain over our copying the brutal example of the British Army. Lincoln said, military necessity does not admit of cruelty, that is, the infliction of suffering for the sake of suffering or for revenge, nor of maiming or wounding except in fight, nor of torture to extort confessions. It is an essential part of our honor and dignity as human beings to respect the honor and dignity of other human beings, even though they plot the most horrible things against us. Because if we don't respect their dignity, we lose ours.
And I would add, this is Gregory Fried speaking, I would add that one needs to think about what the consequences of that argument are. If you believe that dunking someone's head under the water will work in one case, but it won't in another, what other calculations are admissible? John Yoo has argued that the president has the authority to crush the testicles of a prisoner's child in order to coerce a confession or information from the prisoner. Would we accept that? Down that road lies madness.
But to pursue this further, if I could rule out relatives of the detainee and deal only with the detainee himself, and if I could limit it, say, to what was called waterboarding, the argument turns to something that you write about. Machiavelli instructed the prince that to rule entails learning not to be good. A supporter of those aggressive interrogation techniques or torture, if they were proven effective, would say, you're being a moral narcissist to put your own desire to keep one's hands clean ahead of the common good, ahead of preventing that bomb from going off and killing thousands.
The ticking time bomb scenario is an exceptionally rare circumstance, one that our public may be convinced by shows like 24 happen all the time, but in fact is so exceedingly rare that if you allow it to settle your entire interrogation policy, what you end up with is not rare cases where it's implemented with minimal negative effect. What you wind up with is Abu Ghraib.
Well, in the book, you agree on nearly everything, despite your different political affiliations. I should say, despite your being father and son, because that would be a good enough reason to disagree. But you do differ in the end on this question. If President Bush and his subordinates knowingly violated laws and treaties in their policies on interrogation and on surveillance, should they be put on trial? Should they be prosecuted for it? Gregory Fried, you said yes.
Well, first of all, the kind of actions that were authorized by the Bush administration are unequivocally crimes, according to U.S. law. Furthermore, I find both the specific laws that were broken, the laws against torture, and the theory which empowered the president to do those things so dangerous that the only way that it can be made clear to the American political system that these are inadmissible actions is through prosecution.
Now, I'm not at all pragmatic about whether torture mm-hmm. is permissible or not, but I am pragmatic about whom you prosecute and when. And it seems to me that in a democracy, for the ins to prosecute those who used to be in is a very dangerous, unpragmatic thing to do. And I know enough about the legal system to know that were there actually to be an attempt to prosecute Vice President Cheney, Alberto Gonzalez, John Yoo, Jay Bybee, those prosecutions would not be resolved until well after the second Palin administration. That's how this would work out. And it's not at all clear that a jury would convict, or indeed that a grand jury would indict.
Charles Fried and Gregory Fried, thank you both very much.
It's been a great pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Robert.
Charles and Gregory Fried's new book is called Because It Is Wrong: Torture, Privacy, and Presidential Power in the Age of Terror. One thing we've learned over the past couple of years, arcane financial jargon that most of us non-experts might not understand can have a big impact on, well, us. Today, Alex Bloomberg and Adam Davidson from our Planet Money team examined one bit of financial jargon that is threatening to grow into another global crisis.
A lot of people, when they try to tell a story, they try to pump up the drama. I caught a fish, Adam, and I swear it was bigger than my sister. You should have seen the teeth on this thing.
Now, sadly, the people who pump up drama, they don't tend to work in finance. People in finance seem to have the opposite instinct. They take dramatic things and then use complex jargon to make them sound as boring as possible. Like right now, several countries in Europe might be effectively bankrupt. Now that is dramatic.
But finance people, this is how they say that. They say sovereign credit spreads in Europe are widening.
Credit spreads in Europe, they've widened to record levels over the past couple of months.
They're still above 9/11, they're above the 81 recession, and they're above the 74 recession.
With explosion to the upside in credit spreads, that's again an indication that credit risk is rising.
That's all footage from CNBC. So what does this mean? Why is it dramatic to say credit spreads are widening?
Here, let's demonstrate. Alex, why don't you play the role of a financial basket case? You have a horrible credit score. You never pay your bills on time. You got lots and lots of debt.
I'll try.
Oh, you could do it easily, I know. And I'll be who I am, a responsible citizen. A great job, sterling credit history.
I think that role's going to be a stretch for you.
Not for me. All right, let's both apply for the same loan from the same bank. All right, action.
Oh, man, they lent me this $100 I asked for, but I have to pay it back with 30% interest.
Yeah, that's because you're a financial basket case. They don't trust you. Me, on the other hand, I got that same $100 loan, and they trust me so much I only have to pay 5% interest.
And scene. So that difference there between the 5% to responsible citizens like Adam and the 30% to basket cases like me, that is called the credit spread.
All right, and let's go back and apply this to Europe. Germany right now is the responsible citizen there, the Adam, if you will. They're in the best financial shape, and when they borrow money, they pay a low interest rate.
But other countries, they are seeming more and more like me, basket cases. Ireland, Portugal, Spain, Greece, it's costing them more and more to borrow money. The interest rates they have to pay are going higher and higher. In other words, credit spreads between them and Germany are widening.
Now, this week, it's not like back in April and May when there were all those terrified newscasts about the imminent collapse of the European economic system. This week, instead, all we hear is that dull phrase, credit spreads across much of Europe have widened.
But that actually means things could well be worse than they were in April and May. There is a real and apparently growing fear that some countries in Europe have not gotten their financial act together and are in more serious trouble than people imagined. If credit spreads widen more, we could see an already sick global economy get much sicker.
And this serious, dramatic fact is right there, hiding in plain sight on the business news pages behind that incredibly dull phrase, credit spreads are widening. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Alex Blumberg, NPR News.
And now to our regular Friday political commentators, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And I want to start with you where Scott Horsley left off just now. President Obama was asked specifically about Pastor Terry Jones in Florida, who had planned to burn the Quran this weekend. And E.J., it was the part of the news conference today, a very long news conference, over an hour long, where the president seemed to be most engaged and most passionate. He talked about Muslim Americans going to school with our kids. They're our neighbors. They're our friends. They're our co-workers. What did you think of what he had to say, and did he go far enough?
Well, I thought he really came alive when these questions came up. About halfway through the news conference, he happened to drop in, I'm quoting him here, that he is somebody who relies heavily on my Christian faith in the job. So he's clearly got in the back of his head these polls on people, you know, a percentage of Americans thinking he's a Muslim. The other part was political, and it was important. You really had a 1-2 punch this week in his speeches in Milwaukee and outside of Cleveland, where he's really rejoined the campaign. And he had evaded the press. He hadn't done a news conference in, what is it, about 3 months or 4 months. And so he is fully present in this campaign. I think you're going to see a strategy where even Democrats who are running away from him in conservative districts need Barack Obama to generate turnout for them. And I, for one, don't think this election is decided yet. And if, in fact, Democrats manage not to lose the two houses of Congress, I think this week will be seen as a turning point starting in Milwaukee and continuing today.
Okay, I want to get back to that in a second. But first, I want to just continue with one thought on the pastor in Florida, David. And there's a lot of soul-searching, maybe navel-gazing on the part of the media about whether we are part of the problem. Are we amplifying hate-filled rhetoric, hate speech, and bigotry by paying attention to a fringe character in Florida?
Any thoughts? Navel-gazing in our profession.
It's a scary thought. Very scary.
We beat ourselves on the back with feathers. I think it's outrageous the number of coverage we've given to this lunatic. Why does somebody on the extreme get to hijack the whole national conversation? And essentially what we've got is a symbiosis between extremists. One group of extremists does something extreme, they get to feel victimized, and then it plays off great for them because they get to recruit members, they get to attract attention, it's great for their movements, but it only elevates the people on the extremes, and it hurts the country. So I do think we've given way too much attention to one guy in Florida.
Kurt, I agree with that. I do think that we're not really giving that much focus to the extremes. I don't know where the extreme left is in the coverage. We are painting a picture of ourselves to the world, though, that's a lot more intolerant than we are. We're getting a lot of examples of various forms of intolerance. And our country, we do have intolerance here, but that doesn't really define who we are at all. And I think what's striking, the one good news about this is how many people came out against what this pastor was doing across political lines. I hope that sends some signal to the world.
Let's spend some time talking about the White House economic message this week, as we heard from Scott. Today, the president said this: we have started to turn the corner. We're not there yet. I was reminded that when I talked to the chairman of the DNC, Tim Kaine, this week, he said the theme was, we are building the ladder to climb out of the ditch. David, can the Democrats do better than that? If you're thinking of high-flying campaign rhetoric, where does that get them?
Well, I mean, what they're doing, I think, responsibly on the policy grounds is doing something long-term. Look, our problems are structural. The unemployment rate is high because of structural reasons. We've had a lot of jobless recoveries. You can't fix it over the next year, probably. But you can do a couple things that can make us better in the long run, 5 years out. And Obama's done a very important one this week, which is a potential infrastructure bank to get the roads and ridges and airports up. But that's one policy. And that policy, for example, includes giving tax breaks to big business. But then he gives his political speeches, and he attacks the idea of giving tax breaks to big business. And so there's a contrast between his policies, which I think are modest but pretty good, and the political rhetoric, which is pretty traditional us versus them rhetoric, which, by the way, I don't think will work particularly well. It didn't work particularly well in helping John Corzine get reelected in New Jersey or in beating Scott Brown in Massachusetts. But underneath the sort of normal populist rhetoric, there are some pretty decent policies that came out this week.
EJ, you mentioned earlier you were leaving open the possibility of a November surprise. In other words, that the Republican stampede and the surge that we're talking about all the time now, you're saying maybe not so fast.
Right. I do say not so fast. In other words, clearly the Republicans will gain a bunch of seats. The Democrats are defending some very difficult seats, some of which they were bound to lose. But you can't mobilize the Republican base more than it's already mobilized unless they start voting three or four times each. There are a lot of Democratic votes out there. They're just not showing up in the enthusiastic to vote pool. That's where Obama can make a difference. And I'm starting to sense from Democratic candidates that they're not complacent. They know it's a hard year, but some of them are starting to think they can pull this out. So if you did end up with the Democrats narrowly hanging on to both houses, what might have been seen a year ago as a pretty good Republican performance is now going to be seen as a defeat.
Can I like 5% agree with EJ, which
okay.
is up to my health levels?
You know, very generous of you, David.
And I'm hearing this from Republicans, too. They think a lot of this talk is way overblown. The conventional wisdom these days is Republicans will pick up 60 or 70 seats and maybe even the Senate. And I kind of doubt that. And for this reason, I think people are upset about the Democrats, the amount of spending, the amount of concentration of power. So they register that upset by saying, I'm going to vote for Republicans to pollsters. But when you actually get in the voting booth, it's not just registering upset. It's actually voting for someone. And when that choice is made, it's a different sort of choice. A certain percentage will pull back, and that'll be for substantive reasons. The Republicans will stop a lot of the spending. But do they actually have an economic policy to heal the long-term unemployment? That they haven't really presented yet. So I suspect there'll be a little pullback from where we are in the polls.
Okay. EJ and David, thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
EJ Dionne of the Washington Post and Brookings Institution and David Brooks of the New York Times.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. 100-foot-tall waves can be monsters that prowl the sea, nightmares to haunt our dreams, and seductive temptresses with a siren call to adventurers. Susan Casey has written a book about great waves and those who seek to solve or ride them. It's called The Wave, In Pursuit of the Rogues, Freaks, and Giants of the Ocean. Ms. Casey is also editor-in-chief of O, the Oprah magazine, and joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And you open your book with kind of a startling story, I guess about 10 years ago, the story of the ship Discovery.
Yes, this 230-meter-long research ship was trapped in basically a vortex of giant waves for several days. And they were waves that ranged from 60 on average to more than 100 feet tall. So I began to investigate that.
Now, this was a British research vessel, right?
Yes.
And when they first said they're 100-foot waves, people are very skeptical about that, right? Because, as you say, the weather patterns wouldn't seem to dictate that.
And physics, linear physics, wouldn't allow for waves that big to be in certain sea states. And for decades and even centuries, mariners had said, you know, there were these incredibly big waves mm-hmm. and we just escaped and nobody believed them. And it was only in 1980 that we got satellites, and it was more than 15 years after that that it was actually proved that there are these 100-foot waves that can actually appear in, say, a 38-foot sea. But that made no sense at all.
Let me ask you about something called tow surfing, because as we noted in the introduction, there are people who obviously fear these waves, and then there are other people that want to get as close to them as possible.
That's right. And I was very interested in anybody who had been in a position to tell me more about waves this size. And of course, there are the scientists that investigate them. But there is also a group of people who literally know it in a visceral sense because they're in these waves and on these waves. And that mm-hmm. is a very rarefied group of extreme surfers who seek them out. And foremost among them is Laird Hamilton, who's the main character in the book. He invented tow surfing because at a certain point, the waves are moving too fast at a certain size for a human, any human, to be able to paddle into them. So to quote him, that the best waves in the world, you know, were going to waste. And Laird has a very inventive nature and, you know, started tinkering around with a number of other people to try to figure out, well, how can we ride the biggest waves in the world? And they invented a technique which is now, I guess, probably about 15 years old that involves jet skis and water ski ropes and special equipment, all of which was created largely, I think, in Laird's garage.
Well, speaking of all that, he's not in his garage, but he is at the studios of NPR West. Laird Hamilton joins us. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me ask a question. Are you nuts?
You know, am I? I would say definitely not. I would think probably more on the sane side than most of the people that live in cities. And really, I'm doing it not only because we're able to, but because for us, it's like an exploration. What can we do? How far can we go? And really, I do it to continue to develop my relationship with the ocean and have a more intimate and a deeper relationship. And I say this all the time, that just to be in the presence of a giant wave is something of to experience dinosaurs or to experience something that is really unexperienced by normal man or by any man. And to have that kind of opportunity, these are once-in-a-lifetime moments that take your whole life to be able to experience.
Are the number of 100-foot rogue waves on the rise?
What I've really discovered from talking to numerous scientists is the answer is most likely yes. A very large rogue wave comes as a result of a very big storm, and then the instability of the waves, the steepness. Steep waves lend themselves to sort of freaking out and becoming these rogue waves that are very unstable, and they're almost like avalanches of water, where one wave will all of a sudden grab the energy from, say, three or four waves around it and become this teetering monster that just doesn't act like a normal wave. And as the weather becomes more volatile and more shifting, which, you know, climate change is a very big topic and nobody completely understands it, but what's becoming clear is that we're getting more extremes. And that's going to lend itself to feistier seas, bigger storms, steeper ocean conditions, which in turn will create these waves.
Laird Hamilton, I know you've been asked this before. What's it feel like to be on one of those waves?
To describe it as in words is to describe a color. You know, it's something all-consuming. It's an experience that I think it changes who you are. I just feel so alive from doing it. I feel like I get such great power.
So what's it feel like to wipe out on a huge wave?
It's the moment where you totally relinquish any true control over what you're doing. There's no place really in life that does it quite like that. When you do fall or you do get hit by one, you're just at the mercy of the wave, and it dictates. And, you know, sometimes those are the most thrilling rides of all, unfortunately.
But have you ever thought
this is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, I have. I've thought that this is it, and more than once.
I remember a mountain climber telling me once, I forget how many mountains he climbed, but he said the problem with thinking that this is it is that you might cease to try, that if you accept, okay, this is the end of my life, this is fate, then you won't push yourself that extra scintilla that sometimes brings you out of it.
I don't disagree with that, but I think my this is it means this is it. I better really try now.
Susan, I was on a ship this summer for a couple of weeks with my family, and I don't think I would have taken that trip if I'd read this book beforehand.
I had a couple of people say to me, I read this on a boat, and I don't know if a boat is the very best place to read it, but the last thing in the world I would want anybody to do is fear the ocean after reading this book. I mean, one of the main points of the book is this is our world. I mean, it covers 71% of the planet. It's something like 95% of the planet by volume, and we know so incredibly little about it, and every scientist I talked to said that. And this is, to me, the amazing thing is that this spectacular force of nature, these rogue waves, were up to 15 years ago considered not to exist. I mean, and how is this possible that we don't know about this force of nature? So to me, the most important thing about the ocean, and I think I know Laird agrees with me, like, is that we explore it. It's our own planet. It's spectacularly beautiful, mm-hmm. and it's really, really powerful. It can take us out. So let's learn about it. Let's respect it, and let's not consider land to be the sole province of our turf.
Well, thanks both very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Susan Casey in New York, and the great Laird Hamilton is at NPR West. Susan Casey's new book, The Wave, In Pursuit of the Rogues, Freaks, and Giants of the Ocean. Mr. Hamilton?
Yes.
Which one are you?
Yes.
Rogues, freaks. That was my thought.
It would be yes. Yes and yes and yes.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. 9 years ago today, terrorists hijacked 4 U.S. passenger planes and crashed them into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. The victims of those attacks are being remembered today at ceremonies in all 3 places. Elsewhere on this program, we talk with New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg about his memories of this day and its meaning and the controversy over the proposed Islamic Center near the site where the World Trade Center once stood. Today's anniversary comes in the midst of heightened anti-Islamic sentiments. It coincides with the end of Ramadan, the Muslim holy month. For the first time since the 9/11 attacks, the feast celebrating the end of Ramadan falls at the same time as the anniversary. And it's an awkward coincidence for America's Muslims, as some communities are scaling back their celebrations or simply postponing them, worried they might be misconstrued. NPR's Jamie Tarabay reports.
Ramadan goes by the lunar calendar. So every year, the month of fasting is about 11 days earlier than it was the year before. Kashif Munir, a doctor living in Ellicott City, Maryland, with his family, hopes non-Muslims understand that.
It's not something that we planned. It just happened to fall that way. And our intention is to celebrate our holiday, not to, you know, celebrate 9/11 or anything like that.
Normally, because Muslims don't get the day off for Eid, they plan to celebrate the weekend following. This year, though, mindful of 9/11 and all the controversy of recent weeks, including the proposed Islamic Center in Lower Manhattan and the Florida pastor's plan to burn the Muslim holy book, Muslims around the country have made tomorrow, not today, the day they'll be out having fun.
I'm sure there's some people who would try to take advantage of Muslims celebrating.
Imam Jawhari Abdul Malik is director of outreach at Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center in Northern Virginia.
So we've said to our community, take that day after Eid or the day of Eid and make it a day of worship, a day of service, a day of prayer and reflection, which is a part of what the Eid is about, and then for that community gathering to defer it to another day.
Muslim groups have booked moon bounces, pony rides, and even reserved tickets for Six Flags for September 12th, knowing ahead of time that organizing these activities for today would have been inappropriate. The Munir home is full of family. Kashif's mother fries a Pakistani potato dish called pakora on the stove. Kashif's parents live with them, and his brother Wakas and sister Sonia are here from out of town with their children. Kashif says the Muslim community knows it needs to be sensitive around this time, even as he sees glimpses of hostility from patients he's treated for years.
And sometimes I'll point it out. I'm like, I'm Muslim, and how have I treated you these, you know, 6 years that I've known you or whatever? And then they're, no, we didn't mean about you, doctor, you know, so. But, you know, it's tricky.
As Americans, Kashif says they mark 9/11 as well. So in between the prayer and reflection, there's also a moment of remembrance for the attacks. But Eid is also a time of celebration. There are 9 children tearing about the place. Everyone gets presents, including the grown-ups. Kashif points to his wife Sadia, who's moving slowly about the kitchen. She's 9 months pregnant and due any moment.
I had to buy her 3 gifts, because one was the end of Ramadan and Eid. One is we're going to have a baby. And then one is our anniversary's next week, too.
Whatever else may happen for Muslims in this country, at least they won't have to deal with this delicate timing issue again for a while. Wakas Munir says what they're all thinking.
Lunar calendar, we won't have to deal with this for another 30 years. So.
Actually, more like 33 years. Jamie Tarabay, NPR News.